And right, today's topic is Buddhism for Humanity. So what does this really mean? So basically what we like to highlight here is that Buddhism is for human world, is for us human beings. Why do we have this saying? Some of you may say, yeah, Buddhism is for human beings. The reason why this topic was being brought up, because from time to time, you find that Buddhism goes through evolution, and as it spread to different areas in the world, because of the cultural influence and also the traditional culture or beliefs that that area has, sometimes Buddhism merged into the culture and something has changed. And that's why over time, we have a great master who saw that the essence of Buddhism has started to die, to get go astray, or to get detoured. So they try to highlight the importance and of the essence of Buddhism and try to bring it back to where it's supposed to be. So first thing that we'd like to highlight is that we have to understand that Buddhism, when Buddha expounded the teaching to us, the aim is to help the people and the world. So the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, attained enlightenment, he realized the truth. Of course, when he teach, he also wished that through the teachings, it will gradually guide people into realizing the truth as well. But of course, when he teach, he need to make sure that the teaching is suitable for the acceptance levels of the people. Whatever the Buddha realized is very profound, very abstract. If he starts to talk about what he has realized, a very abstract kind of truth, ordinary person who still have a lot of attachment will not have a clue on what he's talking about. Then it doesn't achieve the purpose of helping the sentient beings. And that's why, and on the other hand, if he tries to teach and just to make everyone happy, but not being able to guide you into the truth, then that defeats the purpose as well. So that's why while Buddhism propagate in this human world, there are two things very important for us to remember. And that's something for universe to remember as well. First is that whatever we are doing must be in accordance to the truth. And the second thing that you need to consider is that, yes, we want it to be in accordance to the truth, but then it has to be in accordance to the acceptance levels of the audience as well. Then only you can achieve the purpose of sharing the Buddha's teaching with the people and guide them gradually to the truth. And because if we don't play equal importance on this, some people are like to talk about something very philosophical, very profound all the time, and not relating to daily life, not relating to the audience, then you find that it becomes too abstract for a lay person to understand. They say, oh, Buddhism is too hard. It's like something from outer space. We can't understand. So the lay people, the normal people will still lead their life as it is because they can't understand the teaching that defeat the purpose. And if we overemphasize catering the needs of people and lost the true meaning, then it will be no longer relevant as well. And that happened a lot in our society today, where we try to entertain the needs of people. A lot of Buddhist organization, monastery, try to attract more devotees. So you got all kinds of services, all kinds of activities, make it more interesting, even singing, dancing, although it's Buddhist song, Buddhist dance. But then a lot of people come just because it's merry, it's joyful, and after that it's like a big party, finish, and then go home. That's it. Not relating to the truth, then it, especially if it got nothing to do with Buddhism at all, then you find that it may end up not relevant anymore, and the essence of the Buddha's teaching will gradually lost. So that's why it is important for us to remember how can we propagate the Buddhism in this world, so that it is in line with the teaching, at the same time it helps the people. And so Buddhism for humanity, first thing that the Buddhism for humanity emphasizes is right moral values. And that's something very appropriate, or something that all culture thinks is important. Good moral practice in the human world, we should first behave like a proper person, taking up responsibility and our duties properly as a human being before we can talk about helping others and guiding others. And you find that by talking about good moral values, it tends to click people well. I was talking to a devotee on Tuesday, and she's a Buddhist, but then there were a cult member who keep always talking to her, because she's an elder. She went to the park to play Tai Chi, and then there was another group of people there, and they like to convince her to go to their temple, which is a cult, which is not a Buddhist temple. So what they tell her was all about how to be a good person. So she thought, oh, that's fine, how to be a good person, especially as elders, and they look at the youngster these days, are not that dutiful, not doing dutiful respect very well, and they think that, yeah, they are teaching us good as well. It's nothing to do with enlightenment, it's nothing to do with nirvana, but at least it's talk about good, to be a good person. And so she thought, yeah, it what they said was nothing wrong. So until she go to the temple, but at least she got a bit of right understanding, because she knows that the statue that they're worshipping is not a Buddha. It's not a Buddha. And they try to convince her to become their disciple. So, but then she say, I know that they are not paying respect to the Buddha, they're worshipping something else. But then what they say was not too bad as well. It's about to be a good person. And that's why she thought, it's no harm making friends with them and occasionally go and participate just because we are all friends. So I say, you have to be very, very careful of your own right understanding. Yeah. So that's, you see how cults sometimes use this method. And there's, of course, the teaching is there's nothing wrong. Good moral values. Especially for some parents when they got kids who are rebelling. They thought, yes, these teachings are good. And they want all their kids to go there and listen. So that's why you can see that to have good moral values is actually a common wish for most people, right? So the Buddhism to propagate in this human world, firstly, to establish right moral value practice in ourselves is very important, because Buddhism talk about cause and effect, talk about kindness and consideration, talk about caring and also non-selfish. So in other words, we need to reflect our own behavior and make sure that we don't harm others, and make sure we do our part to care for others. So this is just an introduction on why we want to talk about the Buddhism for humanity, that it has to make sure that we comply to these two, that's the truth and acceptance levels of the people. Now, so why do we highlight humanity here? So it was because in the 19th century, or in the early 18th century, so this 1900, during the 1900s, especially in Asia, Southeast Asia, especially in Buddhism in China, it's in a state of declining. So Buddhism achieved the peak. Buddhism arrived in China in the Han Dynasty, which around the 1st century BC. And around the Tang Dynasty, Buddhism in China achieved the peak, where we have the Master Tripitaka travel to the West to get scripture. So he came back, and because in China from the 1st century to the 5th century, there were 500 years of emperors who have given a lot of support to translation work. And that's why there were a lot of resources that were being translated in Chinese. And that's why this day you find that the Chinese resources are abundant. So because he was supported by the emperor supported the translation court, provide all lodging, accommodation, food, whatever is needed, and even invite elites, all these experts in the country to come to this translation court. So because this is supported by the emperor, of course everyone wants to be to be involved. So you find that they got all the expertise in the translation court, and the translation were done not like we all now a scholar translate a book. They basically translate in a group where you got people of different expertise. Talk about someone translate the Indian language into Chinese, and then you got people who understand the Dharma better to make sure that the translation is in line with the teaching, and then someone refine the Chinese and make sure that it reads nice in Chinese. At the same time, it doesn't divert from the meaning. So the translation go through a lot of process, and there were audience listening as well. And that's why in the translation court at that time, you find that it's like a Dharma talk as well. There's like a panel in the front doing all this translation. They have discussion. The audience can sit down there and listen. And then if you have question, and after they translate, they basically read out to everyone, so the audience will become a proofreader. That you listen, and if you have question, you can ask. And then they will then try to see, is it because you don't understand the Dharma, or is it because the translation has a problem? So this kind of translation is a bit more objective in a way that it's not just from one person's view. So that's why you find that the Chinese translation are quite accurate, and also they are abundant. So what happened was in China, so Tang Dynasty, and then after that, it goes up to the 1900s, that's around 2,000 years after Buddhism arrived in China. So Buddhism has blend into the culture of China, and you find that the emphasis on the teaching start to change, has changed a lot. So in the 1900s, that's the early 18th century, you find that Buddhists tends to place, well, this is Buddhists in China, in Southeast Asia, tends to place a lot of emphasis on things like death and ghosts. Even up to today, you find that a lot of Chinese Buddhism tends to emphasize a lot on death. And so, first talk about, why do they talk about death? Well, in Buddhism, we talk about we have to end the cycle of life and death. There's nothing wrong with that. We practice in order to end the cycle of life and death. But then, the Buddhists in China tends to put too much emphasis on learning how to die properly. So you ask a lot of practitioners, they will say, we need to make sure that we recite the name of the Buddha, we prepare ourselves so that at the blink of the death, we die peacefully. And so they diligently recite the name of the Buddha, doing all the generosity to accumulate merits for themselves so that they can have a good death. Rather than thinking of how can we live our life according to the Buddha's teaching, although they may still doing things according to Buddha's teaching, but the aim is more preparing for death rather than making their life more meaningful. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. So, and some of you may see this situation around. So that's not, because that this is not a good concept, because if you ask non-Buddhists, the non-Buddhists will think, why all these Buddhists are not proactively in engaging in the society. The Buddha talk about compassion, engaging in the society, but the Buddhists are too busy reciting, preparing for their own good death. it's like contradicting to the teachings of the Buddha. So even up to today, you may find some of the Buddhists as such. They don't care so much about, you ask them to do some other charity or some help with the society, things that are not necessarily relating to Buddhism, say for example, care for environment, things like that. They don't care. They say, I have to make sure that I finish my homework of reciting the sutra, reciting the name of the Buddha, and so on. So they are diligently preparing themselves, but they don't care about others. So is that the right? Is that the essence of the Buddha's teaching? And that's why no wonder there are people who tend to comment that wise Buddhists are not that engaging in the society. Look at Christianity. They built hospitals, they built schools. What about the Buddhists? Whereas Buddhism talk about compassion. So that is a situation that happens in China. So Venerable Taishi at that time, his great master, advocated a reform, emphasized on life rather than death. He says that we need to know how to live in order to know how to die. Because we say living and dying and living is an endless cycle. As long as we have not attained enlightenment, we go around the cycle of life and death again and again and again. And in fact, if you think about it carefully, our life is impermanent. Every day we are not the same. And in fact, every moment we breathe in, breathe out, is a new life. Cell rising and falling, breathing in, breathing out. Every moment we are a new person. If you think about it, every moment is a life and death, life and death, life and death. If you are able to see this life and death in your daily life, and you are able to understand the teachings of impermanence, understand how things change, how we ourselves is a combination of causes and conditions, is a combination of the five aggregates, the form, the sensation, the perception, mental formation, and consciousness that actively works together, understand that we should have less self-attachment. And understand that things around us are as such as well. And understand that if everything is in the process of moving, if we want our next step to be better, we need to make sure that we make use of the present to cultivate as much good causes and conditions as we can so that it moves to the right direction. As if we say, the water in the river keep flowing, our life keep flowing as well. So the important part is this part of the water, if we provide it with good causes and conditions, then the next part will probably be better. If this part, we provide it with a lot of dirt, say for example the water flow here, and then we pour a bag of rubbish in there, the next part will be full of rubbish as well. It continues to flow. You carry the rubbish with you. But if the rubbish comes to the front of you, which is the present, and you start cleaning it away, the next part will be clean. Same thing with our life. And so we need to see the truth of this impermanence, that this life and death happen every moment. It is just at the blink of the death, because our lifespan can come to an end, our physical body don't sustain us anymore. If we haven't seen the truth, it's just a more drastic change of our physical body. If we still have not attained enlightenment, we still have craving for continuous existence, this will continue to flow. And if we can understand this and be able to confront changes with a more peaceful mind, then when death comes, you'll be able to confront it more at ease. So that's why he says we need to know how to live in order to know how to die. If you're not trying to understand your life now and just preparing for death, you may not be able to do that well. But if you are able to understand how what happened now and how things rise and fall, then when death comes, you know that everything is just impermanent. So that's why he tried to highlight, emphasize on life. It is important to make full use of our life, the present, that's important, rather than keep thinking about death. Because it makes Buddhism like a religion that is talking about death all the time. But if you think of we need to live in the present, make full use of present, then to develop our wisdom, then at least we become more proactive in the present life. It makes this religion a bit more lively. We don't want it to become a religion that's so dull and always talk about death, right? So if we cannot understand life, then how can we understand death? And so that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that Buddhism in China, or around that early 18th century, emphasized a lot on ghosts as well. Because the traditional culture in China is that people die, they become ghosts. And that's why you find that even Buddhists, when someone passes away at home, they always think that my grandpa is going to come back tonight. Everyone's so scary. And then they offer food to clothings to the person who passed away, and they burn fake money paper. Why do they do that? Even some Buddhists who think that they want to be reborn in the Pure Land, they still do this. In fact, in the sutra, we say that only the hungry ghost need offering. If you're reborn as a human being, or you're reborn as in the heavenly beings, you got better than what we have here. Whatever food that we have in the human realm will become rubbish for them. Isn't it? And so, if you think that your grandparents has been a good person and recite and has been a devoted Buddhist, we always wish that, and we want to have confidence that they are reborn in a good place. Why do you want to subconsciously think that they have become a ghost? But that's the mentality a lot of Chinese Buddhists have. And that's why they have all kinds of scary saying after someone passed away. Even they are Buddhists, even up to today, that has been a problem. So they didn't realize that it's not necessary that everyone has to become a ghost. As long as we uphold the five precepts, we have been practicing generosity, listening to teachings, practice meditation, at least we can probably maintain our human existence, right? So that's something that happened, and that's why Venerable Taishi, he highlighted Buddhism for human life. He used the word human life to highlight life instead of death. And also human instead of ghost. He said Buddhism should be based on, should regards human as the base rather than ghost as the base. Because of this inclination towards death and ghost, you find that at that time, the Buddhism has presented to the society is that monks and nuns are busy chanting, conducting funeral services, memorial services, and that's their main duty. No dharma talk. Or conducting memorial services, dedication of merits, so that we can help to dedicate merits to those deceased so that they can be reborn in a better place and not to stay as ghosts. And that's something still happen today. That's why you can see that when you come to the seven lunar month, everyone keep chanting and try to dedicate merits, and so that hopefully those beings who are reborn as ghosts will be able to be reborn in a better place. To have this compassion to the sentient beings is good, but then overemphasizing it, if you look at a lot of the Chinese Buddhism monks and nuns, how many percent of their time are spending on teaching Dharma? How many percent of their time are basically conducting services, chanting for the deaf, chanting for the ghosts? And so at the end, the image that Buddhism presents to the society is a religion that conducts services when someone passes away, conducts services when you want to dedicate marriage to the ghost, or you want to help the ghost to have a better rebirth. And that's what happened. And that's why Venerable Taishi at that time highlighted Buddhism for human life to counteract this problem. And also he wants to portray the essence that human life is very important, that we need to, we should try to make use of the human life that we have. As human beings, we have the ability to listen to teachings, we have the memory, we can understand, we can reflect ourselves and correct ourselves, and also we can set determination and courage to practice. So we are in the best position to learn the teaching. So we should try to perfect our moral qualities by practicing the Dharma as a human being, and then maintain our good karma as a human being, and develop bodhi-mind to continue practice as a human being, and try to share the teachings with others. And so in this way, we can gradually progress along the bodhisattva path and attain Buddhahood. So that's what Venerable Taishi has highlighted. So he says that the perfection of humankind is actually Buddhahood. So the attainment is true personal development and perfection. So the perfection of human qualities implies the attainment of Buddhahood. So if we perfect ourselves in our memory, our understanding, that becomes perfect wisdom. If we perfect ourselves in our reflection, and our correction, then it develops into great compassion. And if we have this determination, great determination in purifying ourselves, we attain perfect purity. So you can see that the three special characteristic of human being, when you come to perfection, it becomes the perfection of the human of Buddhahood. So that's what Venerable Taishi has highlighted. Now, so we want to come to Buddhism for humanity. Venerable Inshun, another venerable who's a student of Venerable Taishi, and so he's a bit younger, and he highlighted Buddhism for human world. So one highlighted Buddhism for human life to counteract death, and now Venerable Inshun highlighted Buddhism for human world. Why did he change it? Well, whatever they want to counteract, still similar. So they counteract death and ghosts, still the problem which we have today. And that's why you can see that up to today, still there are people who keep advocating Buddhism is for human world, Buddhism for humanity, rather than for death and ghosts. And why Venerable Inshun highlighted Buddhism for human world is because besides the death and the goals that Venerable Taishi has saw, he also realized that in the later phase of Buddhism in India, around before Buddhism declined altogether in the 12th century. So as I think in the CDT yesterday we did say about the history, how Buddhism initially you got the Buddha's time, during Buddha's time, and then you got the different sectarian Buddhism, and then you come to around the first century BC, the Mahayana teachings become popular, and then we talk about the different the Mahayana teachings, how they try to explain the teachings of emptiness, and then there are different ways of explaining emptiness because of the acceptance levels of the people, you see. So Nagarjuna explained that everything is empty in nature, but not everyone can understand. And they tend to fall into the trap, they're thinking that everything is hollow. So then we have Asanga, who then advocated that we have a consciousness. So it is based on consciousness that we perceive things. In fact, what we perceive are not fixed entity. It was actually a transformation from our consciousness. And with that kind of teaching, it helped people to feel that there's a base. And it is this consciousness that cling to ourselves, that we need ourselves to cycle of life and death. So that also answers the question of how we go around the cycle of life and death. Because if everything is empty in nature, so people tend to ask, what is going on the cycle of life and death? In fact, it is our craving for continuous existence, and that consciousness itself is actually causes and conditions as well. It's not a fixed entity. So, but then for people who can't understand that, they tend to feel scared. And that's why Asanga, another great master, then advocated that we have consciousness. So, and it is through this teaching that some people understand that whatever we see, whatever we perceive, it actually developed from our consciousness. They may not be as permanent as what we thought. And then once they understand the external things are not as permanent and as not tangible or as substantial, or it's not a fixed entity as what they thought, they let go of their attachment. Then they realize that if I don't attach to external thing, then what's this consciousness? Is the consciousness only function when you have an object? When object is, you realize that object is impermanence, is empty in nature, this consciousness have no opponent, then they realize that in fact this consciousness is dependent originator as well. And so that was a skillful way. But then this teaching, some may not understand that well, and so then come the Tathagata Gaba teaching that says that we all have a pure heart in ourselves, like a pearl in ourselves. And it is because of our endless cycle of life and death that we got carried away by our ignorance, greed, hatred, jealousy, arrogance, that our this pure heart has been coated with dirt, or these afflictions. So what we need to do is to diligently practice to clean it. Then your purity will then represent. So that's another way of guiding people. And so, but then at the end, they also say this pure heart that we're talking about, this pure mind that we're talking about, is actually also the Dharmakaya. It is also empty in nature, right? So by eliminating afflictions, attachment, then you realize that, even this thing, this pure mind at the end, this Tathagata Gaba, is empty in nature as well. So that was how Buddhism in India has evolved. But then towards the last part, some people tend to cling on to this pure mind as an entity, and some even think of this pure mind as like a big eye, a big pure eye. That's something that we want to return to at the end. And so that then leads to Brahmanism's ideology. Because Brahmanism's ideology is to, at the end, return to the Mahasvara, who is pure. And that's how the Tathagata teaching initially was a skillful means in guiding people to understand how we can purify ourselves, so that it's a bit more encouraging. But then at the end, people tend to cling things that this pure mind is something very magnificent, and that's where we want to return to, and they still cling on to that as a real entity. And so that then leads to that leads to attachment, and also at the end it tends to merge with Brahmanism. Because Brahmanism talks about how we practice and they want to finally return to the heaven to be with a pure big God. And so then that in the last phase of Buddhism, there was a shift that they associate Buddhism with devas and heavenly beings and also look upon returning to heaven as the ideal. And so it starts to shift it away from its original essence, where and it starts to be began to forsake the human world as the basis of practice. So people start to regard the heaven as a place they would accomplish their perfection. Some even start to say, because as some of you have read the sutra, you know that heavenly beings are more magnificent because of their merits. They usually are very, very tall. They got long life, and their lifestyles are more magnificent. So some people start to think that the Buddha must be magnificent. So he must come from the heaven. Where does that teaching come from? We do not know. But people start to have that kind of imagination, that they think that Buddha must come from the heaven. Because Buddha is such a great teacher, so he must be magnificent. How can he be so ordinary like us? So they start to think that the Buddha come from the heaven, and that a person should go to the heaven to perfect themselves. And so at the end, there's an overemphasizing on heavenly gods and eternal life at the end. So that was. And it was then, after that, that Buddhism started to diminish in India because it merged with Brahmanism. So Venerable Insun saw this, that Venerable Taishi has seen what happened in China, death and ghosts, overemphasizing on death and ghosts. And Venerable Insun, through the history of Buddhism in India, saw how overemphasizing in gods and heavens can also lead to deterioration. And that's why he bring it back to human work, humanity. So you can see the compassion of these great teachers, that why they want to highlight this term. It's not saying that they want to start another sectarian. It's actually to counteract the problem that they saw at that time. And this problem continue up to today. But then at least we got these two venerables who have highlighted and allowed some of us to realize and try not to fall into the trap of holding on to some superstitious teaching and also a wrong way of understanding the teaching. So Buddhism for human world emphasizes not only that Buddhism is we should not overemphasize on death and goals and not overemphasize on God and eternal life. And what Venerable Insun wants to highlight is that human realm is the most important. So when we talk about the cycle of life and death, we have the heavenly beings, the heaven, the heavenly beings, the human, the animals, the hungry ghosts, the hell. Asura, sometimes we say they are, sometimes it can be in human being, it can be in heaven, and yeah, it depends on their characters. So sometimes we say there's this five destiny, sometimes we say six realms, but because Asura can sort of merge into some of those, it, because of their special characteristics, their jealousy and hatred. So now, heavenly beings are of good merits, but in the heaven, life is very, very comfortable. Lifespan is very long, and you find that when someone is too comfortable, too enjoyable, and lifespan is so long, we tend to take for granted that everything is okay. Even we ourselves, sometimes you find that as a certain state, when say for example universe is running smoothly, then we tend to become a bit lax in doing something, in attracting, in encouraging members, try to make sure that we got uh, we we keep all members that we have contacted with. But if, like, for example, in the founding time of Unibus, you only have 5 members, one person come, everyone will entertain that person and try to make good friends with that person and try to inform that person, you see? But then when we start to have a bit more, and then you think, oh, yeah, I think we are quite stable, that kind of enthusiasm starts to lose. So same thing with practicing. If you encounter a lot of obstacles, that's why you find that a lot of people encounter obstacles, they go to the temple, they keep praying. When everything runs smoothly, they disappear. So even as human being, you find that happens. So that's why you find that it's very difficult for rich people to come to the temple and devote themselves. And you find that people who are moderate, then sometimes you got suffering, sometimes you got happiness, you sort of motivate you a bit. So when you're in the heaven, it's too comfortable. So it is not easy for them to practice. And so in the heaven, basically we are just exhausting our good karma. Because everyone in the heaven are of good merits. They do not need your generosity. And they have everything they want because of their good merits. So basically, everyone's just enjoying. And so because of that, we are not adding on any good karma. We are just using off the karma, good karma that we have done before. And so therefore, in the heaven, it's not a good place to practice. Although it's magnificent, it's enjoyable, but in terms of memory, they are not as good as us as well. Because too enjoyable, you don't use your brain. You know, like kids during the holiday, they keep playing and keep playing, they forget about everything. Parents always complain, kids today are very forgetful. And I ask the kids, why do you forget? I don't know, I just forget. You know what's in their mind? Games. They got nothing to worry. They just keep playing. So they don't use their brain. And so their memory is not as good as us. And remember when Buddha attained enlightenment, Heavenly King came to the world and invited the Buddha to teach, request the Buddha to turn the Dharma wheel. And the Buddha also tell him, after the Buddha turned the Dharma wheel, the Buddha also tell him to go back to the heaven and tell the people. He go back, he forgot about it. So that's heaven. Right, so their memories are not as good. So, and also if everything is so comfortable, you find your determination and courage to practice will not be there as well. So therefore, in the heaven realm, it's actually not a good place to practice. Then of course in the hell is too much suffering. In the hell, same thing as in the heaven, we are just suffering the past unwholesome karma that we have created. Some people say, how can a person continue to do bad things in the hell? In fact, in the hell, there's endless suffering. So there were a lot of suffering that basically you just suffer the suffering, the unwholesome karma that you have created. And so you exhaust the unwholesome karma, then you may be reborn. It can be reborn as an animal or a hungry ghost or human being. Depends on how good you will be. So, but the most important time is the human being. Because as human being, we have the ability to think. We decide our action. That's why we say it's intentional action. Someone asks you to do something bad. You can decide for yourself, should you follow them? Don't just say, oh, because my friend asked me to do it, so therefore I have to do it. Where's your brain? Intention. So if your decision is to follow your friend and not knowing how to judge right and wrong, or is still wrong because you make decision that you want to follow your friend. You see? So therefore, as human beings, because we are able to think and listen to good teachings, and remember good teachings. So that's, and whatever we are doing, we understand why we do this. And so therefore the karma that we created during our human time has stronger impact on us. Wholesome or unwholesome. And so, and that's why it is during our human time, when we are human being, that the actions, the speech, actions, and thoughts that we have created through our greed, hatred, ignorance, or is it through our patience, forgiveness, and kindness, they all become influential to our future life. So it is our human being, the time when we are human being, that we cultivate all this karma. When you are in the heaven or in the hell, basically you are suffering what you have done when you were human being. And same thing with hungry ghosts and animals. So you can see animals, they have greed, they have anger, they sometimes fight for food, but in fact their intelligence level is not as high. And so a lot of times it's out of instinct. A tiger eat a rabbit out of instinct. Not eating the rabbit because the tiger hit the rabbit and start to punch the rabbit. Just because he's hungry and he want to eat. And after he's full, he won't kill a lot of rabbit and store in the fridge. But we human beings use our mind, we kill a lot and we put in the cold storage out of our greediness. But tiger only eat one and go to sleep. You see? That's different. So that's why the karma created will be different as well. Because we think, and it's out of our greed, hatred, selfishness, that we do something. And that's why the impact is stronger. So, Venerable Yin Shun want to highlight that human realm is actually the most important part in the five in this five destiny. It's the place where we can decide whether we want to cultivate more wholesomeness so that we can upgrade ourselves in our next life. Or we want to do more unwholesomeness and downgrade ourselves next life. It is the turning point. So we are all very lucky now that we are all possessed, we all possessed with human existence. This human existence, how long can it last? We are not sure. So that's why it is very, very important for us to value every moment that we have to cultivate as much good causes and conditions that is in line with the practice of the teaching of the Buddha, so that we can progress life after life. So that we can, life after life, at least we maintain our human existence and that we can continue to learn the Dharma. So in order to do that, we need to make sure that we uphold the precepts, practice meditation, listen to teachings, develop our wisdom. So we need to practice this, and upholding precepts is one of the most important, because if you don't uphold precepts, you kill, you steal, you have adultery, you got yourself intoxicated all the time, then tell lies all the time, then you don't uphold your dignity as a human being. So if we want to maintain our human existence, it is very important that we uphold the five precepts. At least you maintain your human existence. So if you can maintain your human existence, but then you want your human life to be a bit more comfortable as well, then you have to practice generosity. Otherwise, you may just meet the passing mark as a human being, but very poor, a lot of suffering, that is not very conducive for practice as well. So we need to practice generosity. practice generosity in terms of you can give material things, you can give teachings, you can give comfort, encouragement, so they create more links and good links with others. And also we want to be a human being whose mind is a bit more calm, more composed. This day, we find that we have a lot of, you can see that in the society, we have a lot of mental health issue. People who have mental health problem. But we hope that we can have a clear mind, a mind that's composed, a mind that is good for us to learn the Dharma. So practice meditation, listen to teachings. It's very important. So if we cultivate those things, then we maintain our human existence, and then also a human existence with sufficiency in life, a human existence with a clear mind. We don't want to born retarded. That's not good. So so that's why Venerable Insun say, human being, as a human being, is a turning point. We should try to cultivate as much good karma, good seed, that's in line with the learning of the Buddha's teaching as much as we can. So that next life, and we make vow, life after life, we want to be with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, so that when we are reborn next life, very quickly, when we hear the teachings, we feel happy, and we go with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And in that way, we can continue to learn life after life as a human being. So that is something that Venerable Insun highlight, Buddhism for human world. So what to, the part that he wants to count, the effect, the things that he wants to counteract, same thing, there's death and goals, but then he add on also counteracting, over emphasizing on heavenly beings, heavenly gods, and also eternal life. So he wants to bring it down to earth. Human life is actually the most important and is precious. And in terms of advocating to portray the essence of the truth is the same as Venerable Taishi. He highlights that it is important for us to learn the example of the Buddha, to make vow to be reborn as a human being, to learn the Bodhisattva path of life after life. So the other day I was talking to a devotee, she was asking me this question as well. She said, the one who went to the cults, and because the cults tell her that you keep reciting the name of the Buddha, I don't think you are good enough to be reborn in the Pure Land. So the chances for you to be reborn in the Pure Land this life is very minimum. So I think you better come to us, because we can help you to get a better rebirth. Because if you don't go to Pure Land, because that lady thought, if I don't go to Pure Land, I'll go to the hell. That is a ghost mentality. That if I didn't manage to go to the Pure Land, then the next thing will be hell. But I don't want to be in the hell, she said. I don't want to be a ghost. So that's, you can see that there are a lot of Buddhists who don't have that kind of right understanding. And so this cult says that, so don't worry, because you can't go to the Pure, if you can't get yourself to the Pure Land, if you follow us, we can make sure that you go to the heaven. Because that cult, I think they worship some deities, and that's too, then their ultimate aim is to be reborn in the heaven. So that's why you can see that Buddhism is very, very, Buddhism, so-called, in the society today, is very confusing. And that's why we hope that all of you who come to Unibus listening to Dharma Talk every week can develop some right understanding, and make sure that when you go back home, you go back to your own country, your own village, you know how to justify what is right and wrong. Because there are people who are going to give you a lot of hearsay, and you need to make sure that you know what is right and wrong. And so I say, it's not necessary that you need to go to, if you can't be reborn in the Pure Land, that you will become a ghost. And this cult says that you follow them, they can help you to be in the heaven. Are you sure they can achieve that? I say, if their teachings are not right and you follow them, maybe you will become a ghost. Because of wrong understanding, engage into wrong practices, and sometimes may even be worse. So I say, if you are sincere in trying to be reborn in the Pure Land, you have good faith in the Amitabha Buddha, you have good faith in the Pure Land, you also try to practice generosity, uphold the precepts, recite the name of the Buddha, try to always harbor in yourself a kind heart, doing good things, good deeds. So even if this doesn't, if your effort is not good enough to be reborn in the Pure Land, at least you probably will continue to be a human being. And so you just need to continue to be a human being, continue to practice. So I said, the most important thing is to make sure that you uphold the five precepts, practice generosity, continue to recite the name of the Buddha, always immerse yourself in the brightness of the Buddha, think of the purity of the Buddha, the wisdom, the compassion of the Buddha. Then you got nothing to worry. So that's the misconception that a lot of Buddhists has. So Venerable Insun highlighted Buddhism for humanity, Buddhism for human world. That's to bring it down to this world, highlight the importance of human existence and not thinking about heaven or ghosts, right? And at the same time highlights the importance of human world as a place to practice the Bodhisattva path until we attain Buddhahood. Okay? So that's Buddhism for human world. And why Venerable Insun highlighted Buddhism for human world, he also continued to explain that, in fact, if you think about Buddhism for human world, it's not something created by Venerable Insun. It was the Buddha who set the example. So if you think about Triple Gem, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the Buddha, of course, when we pray, pay respect to the Buddha, we think about the Prince Siddhartha who have attained enlightenment in this world. And of course, Prince Siddhartha attained enlightenment in this world, we call him the Shakyamuni Buddha because he came from the Shakyan clan. And so we call him the Shakyamuni Buddha. And through him, he also introduced to us that there are many Buddhas, there are many Bodhisattvas. But then, the one who is closest to us is Shakyamuni Buddha. And Shakyamuni Buddha, if you look at the history of Shakyamuni Buddha, he's down to earth. He's not from the heaven. He's not a heavenly being suddenly disappear in front of us, very tall, gigantic, and and full of brightness and like very magical. But he's just down to earth, like us, right? So he was born in ancient India, in Kapilavastu, and he has a father, he has a mother, and he even have a wife and a son. And eventually he renounced, and he was diligent in his practice, and finally he realized the truth, and he attained Parinirvana at the age of 80. Right? So that shows that he was an ordinary person like us, but he's probably a bit wiser in the sense that he observed, he realized that there's suffering, frustration in life. He didn't just allow himself to just carry on like when he asked his follower, why everyone has to age? Well, the follower just said, oh, this is just natural. Everyone just have to confront it. And everyone in the world just knows that it's something that we have to confront, but no one going to look for an answer. But Prince Siddhartha at that time didn't just sit there and just, okay, I just accept it. He tried to look for an answer. And that's why at the end he found the answer. He realized that because everything is impermanent, and the reason why we have a lot of frustration is because we attach. We didn't realize it's impermanence. We want to go against impermanence. If you understand everything is impermanence and you flow happily with it, as we say, it's just like if you look at the water flowing, you enjoy the flow, then you won't say, oh, why my water flow away? Right? If you feel like, I love this part of water, I don't want it to flow, but it keeps flowing, then that's when you get frustrated. But if you admire and you actually enjoy watching the water flowing, your mind will be peaceful. It's just that everything around us, if you enjoy seeing them flowing, seeing the changes happening, you will be more peaceful. The problem is that when changes happen, we are reluctant. Why are we reluctant? We glue to it. So the Buddha himself, from the historical fact, you can see that the Buddha belongs to human realm. He was not a god or a devil, and he never proclaimed himself as a son of a god or the messenger of a god. So he even says in the Agama Sutra, he said, all Buddhas attend Buddhahood in human realm and not in the heavenly planes. So that was stated in Agama Sutra, and that all Buddhas, not only that Shakyamuni Buddha attained enlightenment as a human being, all Buddha have to go through this stage as a human being, and they attend Buddhahood. So none of them ever done it in the heavens. And the Buddha continued to say, I am a human being too. So that's why the Buddha highlighted that human realm is very important. It's a place that all Buddha attend enlightenment. And so the Shakyamuni Buddha was a human being. He purified himself and completely eliminated all afflictions and ignorance. He possessed ultimate wisdom and compassion. However, as a human being, he too have to eat. He too have to clothe himself and move around. It's not that he become a Buddha, he become special, he do not need to eat. He just suck air. It's normal, right? It's normal. And so that's why he's a true teacher for human race. Because if the Buddha was from heaven, then we say, oh, he's talking about heavenly things. It's not... we can't understand, or his physical body is from heaven, so therefore he can practice meditation. We cannot. So, but then he's setting an example that he was a human being, and therefore we all can practice. And so that's firstly that Buddha himself. So if you look at the triple gem, then you can see that Buddha was a human being, and the Dharma, teachings that the Buddha taught, it's not for the heavenly beings, it's not for the animals, it's not for the hungry ghosts, it's not for the hell people. The Buddha talked about the 12 links. Can you apply these 12 links to the heavenly beings? It is for us. You talk about the 5 precepts, it is also for us. The Buddha said the 8 precepts, that is also for human beings to practice. So, even the Buddha talks about the stages of birth, age, old age, sickness, and death. That's for the human being, because in heaven and the heaven and the beings in the hell, they don't actually experience this growing process as such. They are reborn there because of their karma. This birth, sickness, old age, and death is only happen in human beings and maybe animals, but not the heaven and the hell. So, and the six sense organs, eye, ear, nose, tongues, and so on, these teachings, it's for us, right? It's not for the earthworms or something else. And so you can see that the teachings that the Buddha teach is tailored to our need. To us, he explained how we can look at ourselves as a 5 aggregates. Again, it's us, human being. So that's why you can see that when the Buddha talk about upholding precepts, practicing meditation, good moral conduct, is all tailored to us human being. Because if you teach the dog good conduct, can you teach them about good conduct? No stealing? You got two dogs. You got two plate of food. You find that they fight. They don't care. Right? So, so you can see that the Buddha expounded Dharma with human being as his intended audience. So that's why Buddhism is for human being. The Buddha never preached the Dharma based on the phenomena in the heavens or hells. So at least the Dharma that we know is for us. Maybe the Buddha has his transformation teaching the heaven beings in a different way, but that's not for us. The Dharma that we are learning now is for us human beings, because it tailored to our environment, our physical abilities, and it is for us to apply the teachings. Okay, so you can see that Dharma is also for human being, and Sangha, of course, Sangha human being as well. And you find that when someone wants to become a monk or a nun, one of the questions they are asked that, are you a human being? That has to be asked. If you are not a human being, you cannot be a monk, right? You have been a monk before. Did you answer that question? So because monastic precepts are not meant for non-human, the monastic precepts helps to bring the Sangha members together to have a well-disciplined Sangha order, and so it is all for the human beings to practice. So, and the Sangha members who follow the Buddha at the time, they are all human beings. So you can see that Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that appear in this world, they are all human beings. They are basically for human beings. So why do we end up with a Buddhism that talks about ghosts, death, heaven, and not talking about human being? So the Buddha's teaching is for us human being to practice, to improve ourselves as a human being and progress along the path. So that's something that Buddhism for human world wants to highlight. So and in order to practice this teaching well, the essence of the Buddhism for human humanity, or Buddhism for human world, as we said just then, why it started. And so now let's talk about how we can practice as a human being. So the essence on the practice is that we should try to uphold, we should try to follow good moral conduct, develop body mind. Okay, so as a human being, we try to make vow. Life after life, we want to practice the teachings of the Buddha and until attain Buddhahood. So we hope that we can be reborn in the human realm again and again. So as human being, we practice the Bodhisattva path until the attainment of Buddhahood. That is basically the essence of Buddhism for human world. That we uphold good moral conduct as a human being, we practice meditation, we practice generosity, we listen to teachings, develop body-mind, and practice the Bodhisattva path, and life after life, continue to practice the Bodhisattva path until attainment of Buddhahood. Maintain your human existence. Understand that human realm, to be reborn in the human realm, to be a human being, is precious. Okay? And so, of course, when we talk about Bodhisattva practice, they are ordinary Bodhisattva, they are noble Bodhisattva, they are also great Bodhisattva. So we are all normal, ordinary people. So ordinary people can also start to learn to become a Bodhisattva as a kindergarten or preschool Bodhisattva, as long as we develop our body mind. The special things about us is that we carry out Bodhisattva practice with afflictions. But then we need to have a mind of compassion. Always share the feelings of others. So from where we are, we start to learn slowly. Although we still have a lot of afflictions, but we want to learn from the Buddha and the Bodhisattva their kindness, compassion in helping others. So we learn to open our heart, learn to share the feelings of others rather than thinking about ourselves only. So I think this is a very important practice for all of us, because I think our society has become more and more individualistic. So to understand our own personal character and at the same time see the weakness of our own personal character and open up and learn the embracing virtues of the Buddha and Bodhisattva will help us to be a better person. And the Buddhism for Human World also highlight that it is important to learn Dharma and the Vinaya, or Dharma and disciplinary code, hand in hand. Because sometimes you find that there are people who learn about Buddhism, they like to emphasize a lot on the philosophy, the teachings. They don't care about so much on the precepts. On the other hand, you got someone who are very analytical on the precepts, like a lawyer that analyze that is this in line with that in line with the precepts or not. So in fact, Dharma and precepts, they are actually not contradicting. They are not contradicting. Precepts are set as a guideline to help the Buddhists to have a guideline for their own behavior. But how did the Buddha set all these precepts? It sit on the foundation of the Dharma. Because through the Buddha's enlightenment, he understand the teachings of cause and effect. He understand that everything comes together with the causes, come together by with the coming together of causes and conditions. He also understand that the causes of suffering come from our self-centeredness, our ego, our greed, our hatred, our ignorance, and arrogant selfishness. So the precepts are set in a way that the Buddha tried to set the precepts in line with cause and effect. Make sure that he gives some guideline so that we don't get carried away by our afflictions, our greed, hatred, ignorance, arrogance, selfishness. That's going to lead ourselves to suffering. At the same time, these precepts help us to restrain our afflictions and hopefully at the end reduce our afflictions so that we become more conducive in practice. And he also understands that this is possible because everything is subject to change, everything arises due to causes and conditions. So we now try to provide the right causes and conditions. So he tried to give guidance so that he teach us how we can provide ourselves with the right causes and conditions so that we path our way to a better future. So you can see that the precepts are set not because the Buddha wants to write some rules for everyone. Why did he write these rules? Because there are people, when you say that the teaching of cause and effect, causes and conditions, impermanence, they tend to relate that to natural phenomena, not relating to their own behavior. Or they know that in theory, but when they come to real life, they do not know how to relate that to their life. That happens. Sometimes we talk about cause and effect. You go to a Buddhism quiz, they can answer the question. But then in real life, when they're relating to people, they forget about cause and effect. And that's quite common as well. We know in theory some of the teachings, but then in practice, you find that it's not there. So to make it easy, the Buddha set into the precepts line so that you remember, don't do this, don't do that, as a guideline. But this guideline set on the Dharma, it's based on the Dharma. It's not written without any guidance. So Dharma and precepts is not contradicting. Because it's just like a student go to the school and say, I want to be a good student in the school. Then you say, you have to behave yourself, not to disturb others, or things like that. It's quite general. So sometimes they do not know where is the line. And sometimes your own selfishness or self-benefit something that's more self-beneficial, then you will start to find excuses for yourself to do something and think that that is acceptable. But then if the school rules say, the school will have to set some school rules. This, not to do this, not to do this, not to do this, not to do this. Then if you want to do something and you find excuses to do it, but then you say, no, it's just you should not do this. Then you know that, okay, I'm trying to find some excuses for myself to justify myself to do a certain action, but in fact it's not supposed to be done. You see? So that's why the Buddha set some rules to make it easier for people who cannot apply the Dharma in their daily life using their own analysis. So having the guideline make it easier. And then with the guideline, you use the guideline to restrain your own speech, actions and thought. And then by restraining yourself, if you have the habits to go beyond, then you try to then ask yourself, why? So the Buddha set the rules and therefore I need to follow it. Then you may not understand it in detail. But then you say, why the Buddha set such a rules? Oh, it's because I have this greed in myself. So that's why the Buddha said, don't go beyond. Then you can relate and then it helps you to improve. Right? So, and by applying this in our daily life, you'll find that you help yourself to cultivate wholesome speech, wholesome action, and wholesome thoughts. And also that the Buddhism for human world also emphasized that not only that we think about individual improving individually, to respect the disciplinary code is also to emphasize the importance of the community. Because the Buddha said, especially monastic disciplinary code, to ensure the harmony of the monastery. So, and you find that a lot of the rules are basically reminding ourselves to reflect our own behavior so that it doesn't affect others. And also highlighting our responsibility as a Sangha member in this Sangha order. So the same thing applies to your universe exco, that as individual, you got your individual behavior, things that you need to improve. Everyone wants to learn the Dharma, improve yourself in the Dharma, and that's why you join the Buddhist society. You want to improve yourself in Dharma learning. At the same time, within this organization, we all have our duties, and whatever we do will affect the image of this big picture. So therefore, as a member in this society, we cannot be too self-centered and just think about ourselves. We need to understand how our behavior, especially if you're in the executive committee, how our behavior might affect others or may affect other people's duty and task. So not just from your personal point of view, but see from the global picture. That's very important. Okay, so that's the first thing, unification of Dharma and Vinaya. Second is unification of dependent origination and emptiness. So the Buddhism for humanity also emphasized the understanding of that everything arises due to causes and conditions and is empty in nature. So when we talk about emptiness, it doesn't mean that it disappears. It's just basically saying that it doesn't have a fixed entity. Everything comes together with the coming together of many causes and conditions. It's always in the process of changing. So as in order to do good deeds or to make anything successful, we need to put the causes and conditions together and so that we can achieve something. And after the incident, you have to continue to prepare for the next one. So you have to still continue to accumulate resources for the next one. Right, so everything arises due to causes and conditions, and it is not fixed. It's not saying that you're successful this time, you're going to be successful forever. It's just like, oh, if you have your exams and your assignment, you put in a lot of effort, you got very high mark for this assignment. You're happy for a week. Second assignment come, you have to put this aside and start to work on the second one. You cannot keep telling yourself that I got high distinction for the previous assignment. This one must be high distinction as well. So we have to continue to put in effort, and so everything is arises due to causes and conditions, and it is they are all subject to change, and that's something that we need to remember. And also emphasizing on self-benefit and benefiting others. So we need to improve ourselves all the time, at the same time help and guide others. So the Buddhism for Human World emphasize on the Bodhisattva practice, and that's why also highlight the importance of benefiting ourselves and benefiting others, and also to that leads to that encourage us to have more worldly involvement, and also the emphasize the importance of community, because one individual is difficult to carry out a lot of tasks. And especially in order to help and guide others, you may have a great leader, but a great leader should guide a lot of others who have the same aspiration to come together to continue with this good task. And that's what the Buddhism for Human World likes to highlight. And in terms of the essence of the practice, it also highlights a faith and confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. Diligent effort is very important, and then cultivation of wisdom and compassion. So faith and determination, compassion and wisdom. That's three essential in practicing the Bodhisattva path. And if we remember this and engaging ourselves in the society, purifying ourselves, learning, improving ourselves, at the same time helping others, we make Buddhism a more positive one, and that it helps the world, at the same time it helps ourselves. Okay, is there any questions anyone like to ask?
Venerable, thank you for the talk. I have a few questions that have come across my mind when listening to this talk. First, I would like to ask questions on the proper clothing or manner when we listen to a Dhamma talk.
Okay, proper clothing. Alright, for lay people? Well, lay people, as long as important thing is neat and tidy, don't wear singlets, shorts. That's like, because you are sitting in front of a teacher, even if you are listening sort of MP3 or something, because it's a Dhamma, you want to show your respect. So usually, strictly speaking, usually when we read a Dhamma book or we listen to talks, we try to sit upright and listen attentively with good respect. So of course, in terms of attire, then it has to be attire that is neat and tidy, no indecent exposure.
The other thing is, I don't know, I already asked Emily last time, regarding the positions of Dhamma teacher and listener. I read in the books that to respect the Dhamma, the teacher should be on the higher level than the listener.
Yeah.
So, but we are in the class, it's more likely in the same level.
What? When you say different level, it's just, for example, this is the speaker's table and that is the audience. So you can distinct between the two. So it's not necessary that you need to get a few bricks to elevate it. So as long as it is in a place that is more dominant, that you can very obviously see that this is the table or for the speaker, and that the rest are the audience, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because in my traditions, normally we're sitting or
on the floor. But this is the this is the classroom, so that's okay. As long as it's a dominant place, a place with respect. So you don't push me to a corner and then and I have to scream from there, and then doesn't look like right. So you put at a dominant place, a place where it is more respectful.
The third question is, this is about the leadership in Buddhism. How do you think about the leadership in Buddhism regarding for humanity, like, for example, in climate change or environment, and then human welfare as the world, mm-hmm. and then a world feast. Because I only read news about Dalai Lama talking about world peace, talking about more about social equality, mm-hmm. maybe talking about also what happened in Middle East mm-hmm. or in Africa, mm-hmm. but we didn't read news about other, for example, I don't know, in Mahayana, who is the highest monk, or in Theravada, who is the highest one, then they talk about the conditions of the world currently.
So I think it all depends on who has approached who, and also the, for example, when you talk about environmental issue and things like that, I think there are a lot of people doing things not necessarily on the news, care for environment, a lot of monastery try to conserve resources and things like that, do their part in helping. So because not everyone are that good in their public speaking, in sort of making sure that we have to announce that what we are doing, but everyone knows that we need to care for environment, and they do their part in the monastery, giving and play their role, and that's also a way of their support to care, rather than just so it's not necessary that everyone has to go to the media and say this is what we want to do and things like that. Yeah. So I think a lot of the Buddhist monastery or the Buddhist venerables are doing their part in their capacity. So not necessary in the big capacity, because Dalai Lama is more famous. People like to go and interview him, but the others are usually doing in their own capacity to play whatever they can. Yeah.
So what do you think on the leadership? So because we are not that like Catholic, which has a
yes.
one highest.
That's why Buddhism, even the Buddha say, I'm not a leader. So I'm just a member in the Sangha order. It's a Sangha order that follow the discipline that allows Buddhism to prolong. So it's not, we don't try to highlight a leader. A leader is still within the Sangha order, and it's just that at that time, maybe this person is the main coordinator, and the important thing is the whole Sangha order works together. So that's why in Buddhism, we don't highlight one single figure.
My last question is regarding the questions when someone wants to be a monk, they ask, are you human or not? Can you tell us a story about regarding the background of this one?
Background of this?
Yeah, I think because it was established because of certain conditions.
Yeah. I think there was a serpent or a spirit or something who wants to become a monk as well. Yeah. So I think there was some non-human because that they want to become a monk. And sometimes you got people who are not. Yeah. So. And I think it was some non-human who request to be a monk, but then the Buddha rejected. Yeah. So because the teachings are for human being to practice. Yeah. Okay.
Can I have a question?
Yes.
Something in regards of politics. I mean, in the case, say, for example, if I observe some Buddhist practitioner that they're actually not following the order, the Sangha order. And as a layman by myself, is it right for me to step in and challenge the authority and challenge the fact that they are not obeying the
Now, I think the if the person is still wearing a robe,
yeah.
you still respect him as venerable.
Yeah, but after being observing some.
Yeah, so you like, probably let, it would be better for you to let some other people who are in the right position to go and tell the person rather than you challenge the person because it defeats the purpose and it doesn't, it won't achieve anything. It would be better if, say, for example, this person is not in the Sangha order, but then somehow maybe there are some other of his venerable friends or master that can, or like in some country, they may have some Buddhist council or Buddhist association that can step in if this person is doing something which is too beyond. But then, of course, we have a lot of fake monks this day. Who are not really monk, then those you can probably ask them where did they come from and so on. If you can see that they are very obvious, they are not real monk at all. Yeah. But if a person is a monk and still wearing robe, but then you feel that certain behavior is, you do not like certain of his behavior, but then we still have to maintain our respect as long as they're still wearing the robe. Because, like, for example, in Thailand, Thailand is a Buddhist country. If a monk break the circular law, they have to make them disrobe first before they can catch them. So that's how they actually respect the robe as this person who have ordained. So the Sangha order will have to ask this person to disrobe first before the police can catch them. Any other question? Merits. What's merits in Buddhism? Merits. How do you define merits in Buddhism? So when we say that if you do, for example, you practice a lot of generosity, you create a lot of good friendship, so you practice generosity with a sincere heart, you like to help others, and benefiting others, you like to share teachings with others, you like to comfort others, you find that you accumulate some resources for yourself that it become your resources when, for example, when you want to do something, you got more support. So this is what we meant by that you have accumulated some merits for yourself. So it's like doing good deed, by doing some good deed, continuously doing good deed, we try to accumulate as much good karma for ourselves. And all this good karma will then become a resources for yourself when you want to help yourself or help others. So that's why, for example, the Bodhisattva, they will try to accumulate as much merits as they can. They do as much good deed as they can, not because they want to have a lot of abundance of merits for themselves. They want to have abundant merits for themselves, abundant merits because Bodhisattva needs to help people. If I don't have anything, how can I help you? If I'm very rich and you come and see me and you say, I need help, okay, I give you some money. If I got nothing, I can't help. And that's why Bodhisattva try to accumulate as much merits as they can, but they are just like, they treat themselves like a bank. If you want to give me, welcome. But they don't attach to it. They just take care of it, transfer it to wherever is necessary. So, and these merits come through your good deeds. So it is like we say, when you practice generosity, it is like a seed. One plant, one seed, you grow into a big tree. And you got money in return. So that's generation that one seed that generate into many fruits. That's what we mean by, you can probably imagine that's a bit like the merits that become resources for you to use. Does it make sense? But important thing is, don't calculate the merits. Don't say, I have donated $1. How much merits do I have? No merits. If you tend to attach and you become very calculative, your merits will be very limited. But if your mind is boundless, your merits will be boundless. If you help someone with a sincere heart, letting go, just feel happy and don't cling on to it anymore, and you always do that, you find that your merits will be just boundless. But if you do something and you're very calculative, you help your friend and you keep thinking that I have helped you, you have to help me next time, even your friends can sense that. Even next time you want to help the person, that person says, I'll do it by myself, because the person feel a bit of burden that when I accept your help, you always think that I owe you something, and so they rather not to accept your help. But if you are a very easygoing person, you help and you make everyone so happy, you find that your friends will be very 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 nice to you, and they will just come to your help when you need them. And sometimes you find that more comes back rather than, although you only help one person, but because your friend keep telling his or her friends that you are such a good person, and when you need help, a lot of people comes. But you feel very calculative. At the end, you may become nothing. Okay. Right. Yeah.